Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another award-winning episode of Real Recovery, possibly the finest and fastest hour on radio every week. And we are an award-winning show. And we are just looking at the fifth trophy case that's being built here for the awards. Isn't that right, George?
Looks nice, Bill.
Yeah, I think it's a little... I like the cherry wood that they've used. It's nice cherry.
Is that what that is?
It's cherry wood. You probably don't have that in your house because that's a finer wood. You're probably more of an oak guy.
I'm more of a plastic guy.
Oak plywood guy.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm just relieved we're on the air tonight. It's, no place you'd rather be on Sunday night than right here on Real Recovery.
Absolutely not.
And we almost completely did not get on the air, but as luck would have it, we're on the air. And I should explain what happens here again. I'll probably be talking over your head. I do that often because I'm getting used to it. I know. Well, to put this as simply as I can say it, the flux capacitor on the manifold valve stuck, which feeds the microphone line and the broadband intake valve. But Alex cleaned it out and he used just a paperclip. So we're fully operational at 1,900 hours. That's military talk. Obviously, I've lost you once again.
A couple times, yeah. It's too bad he wasn't here last week when you spilled your water on your computer. He could have helped you on that one, too.
Yeah. You know, we're just a couple of kids with dreams.
We've gone a lot farther than I ever thought we would.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I dreamed to one day own the royalty rights to the exclamation mark. I would like that.
That would work well.
People use that a lot when they're sending text messages and emails. Exclamation mark all over the place. But tonight is another exclamation mark episode of Real Recovery. And we're talking about, we got a very special guest coming on tonight. And he has lived on the other side of addiction, where he has lived with a spouse that has struggled with addiction. And he's going to tell his story tonight of living with someone who has an addiction.
And we don't talk about that enough. And sometimes for the person who has lived with us, and I am a recovering addict, all the attention is on us when we have the problem, and all the attention is on us when we have the recovery. And a lot of times it's like, well, the other person is just supposed to just move right along with us and act like it never happened. And that's very damaging.
I agree. Now, last week we talked about step four. So as luck would have it, we'd move on to step five.
I'm glad, because that's what I prepared for.
Good. I'm surprised you prepared.
Well, I did.
That comes as a surprise to me.
It comes as a surprise.
I did not know that about you.
I'm always prepared, Bill.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. But step four.
And this week, I'm on the right step. So we've got that. We admitted to God and to ourselves the exact nature of our wrongs and to another human being. And so what we're going to look at on this step is we looked at our inventory last week, and this week we're going to admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And what we're looking at is our sinful behavior, our selfishness, our anger, our resentments, our fears, and take these to God. Where I think people miss the step, Bill, is we focus on giving it to another person. I want to get forgiveness for my sins. And the admitted to God is a big part, confessing to God. We need to get forgiven for our sins.
Step one.
We admitted we were powerless. Our life was unmanageable.
Right. But step one is repenting of our sins.
Well, if you're really sorry about it, don't do it anymore.
Stop it.
Don't do it. You don't have to.
Yeah. How about knock it off?
Right now.
Yeah. Stop it. Does that help at all?
It does.
Okay. Let's talk about step four before we move into step five, just for review.
A little review.
Never hurt anybody, George. So if we're going to review step four, we're going to take an inventory of the things that we have done wrong. Is that correct?
We're going to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves.
And Dr. Glenn Pickering, who we had on last Sunday night.
He was so good.
He was very good in helping us unpack that bag.
Yes.
And the word fearless is something that we all... It's a word we're all attracted to, but maybe we have no clue how to make that word our own.
Part of what we need to do is get into this with complete abandon. We need to pray first, God, that we will be honest, that he will give us the insight and the power to feel free to do this. It's a very courageous step.
Okay. Let's look at step five, George, because you're the expert here, and I'm kind of on the outside looking in because I have never really been through the 12 steps except for academic reasons. But you have really lived step five, and obviously God knows everything that you've done and everything that you're going to admit. But when it comes to admitting to another human being the nature of our wrongs, how good are we at that? And do we hold some things in inventory that we really don't want to quite talk about or reveal? Or do we tell half-truths? What is usually what happens? Explain.
My experience on both ends of this has been the following. And I've listened to a lot of Fifth Steps, Bill. And usually when people get done, I say, now I'm going to get up, Bill, and I'm going to be back in a couple minutes. And I want you to tell me the three things you weren't going to tell me.
Wow.
And almost every person goes, how'd you know that?
Wow.
Well, that's because we all do that.
Hmm.
What I really want to do if I want to be free from my addiction, free from my sins, free from my old life, is I need to be totally honest here. And that's hard for us. And usually we don't do that unless we are in trouble and we realize this is not going to change unless I do it. I always pray before I do a step five or I hear a step five for God's will to come through and the truth to be there.
How able are people in this position? How able are they to even tell the truth?
Well, addiction is a pattern, a disease.
Isn't there so much
lives.
Sickness going on there that they
sure.
can't even tell the truth?
Right. Right. I saw a movie that's playing called Flight the other day. And in it, at the end of the movie, the guy's talking and he says, this is the first time in my life that I've really started telling the truth. And it was a very poignant moment. There was a consequence that came with it. I don't want to give away the movie. But that stood out to me because I know in my own recovery, there was a time where I don't want to lie anymore. What happens is our whole life becomes a lie. We are who we are around people that we're around. We're a chameleon. I'm one way around my church friends, one way around my using friends, one way around my work friends. And gosh, they can never all meet, Bill, because then the truth will come out. But what we're doing with step five is we're going to have God shine his light of truth on us. And it's our time to confess and start the repenting process. If you're really sorry about what you're doing, confess it and don't do it anymore.
But this is an incredibly scary step. It has to be one of the most intimidating things a person's going to do because they're laying all the cards on the table. And I think when it comes to laying all the cards, you have to lay even the things that are in the black box, which are the things that are the most deeply hidden items in there.
Absolutely.
And I've used this analogy before, and I repeat myself on occasion because I have limited material, as you know.
You do.
Of course.
It's good, though.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, you know, but when a plane goes down, they always look to see what's the black box. They find it, and they look to see what's in it because they're going to find out what was said right before the plane went down. And usually there's a lot of, you know, we all carry around a little black box. Inside it is our deepest secrets, things that are making us sick, keeping us from living life abundantly.
Here's what's helpful. God already knows everything. You're not telling him something he doesn't know. What we're doing is going through the exercise to hear ourselves say it. That really drives it home. Am I willing to do this? You don't have to be, but pray for the courage. It's not for cowards. Recovery, mm-hmm. Christianity, it's not for cowards. But is it worth it? Absolutely. Nothing else works.
Yeah. Would you say that step five is one of the big keys to freedom? Is this one of the steps that really help people turn the corner?
I think so, Bill. I like to go to scripture a lot. And in Proverbs 28:13, it says, he who conceals his sin does not prosper, but whoever confesses and renounces them finds mercy. That's what we're looking to get here. We're looking to get the mercy and grace to start our new life walking with Jesus. And we have to put the old to bed. We have to put that man to death. And the way to do that is to confess our sins and ask for forgiveness.
So you're up against a very daunting step. It's a very intimidating thing to do.
It is very intimidating.
It requires a lot of humility. And
honesty, humility, and willingness.
Mm-hmm.
Got to be willing to do this. Our way has not worked. And if I truly believe that God has me, if I truly believe this, and I know he already knows this, this isn't a big leap for me that I needed to confess this and get on with my life.
Mm-hmm. It's more discussing this with another person, I think, which makes it tough. And maybe you ask God to help you with that person?
Yes.
Has
to be trustworthy. I want to make sure that what I said stays there.
Yeah, but if you've been lying to me for a long time, and you probably have, it's a good thing there's glass
between
us.
I really do like your car, Bill.
No. But,
I mean, a lime green Prius, I wish I had one.
Yeah. It's now has two dents. It used to have one, now it's got two. Seriously, because of the storm last Sunday,
yeah.
I smashed the front of it a little bit. It's just sad.
It is sad.
It is.
Where's the Kleenex in there? How did you smash the front of it?
Well, I was stuck in a snowbank, and I was trying to rock it out of the, you know, you got to rock it, but it has no traction.
Okay.
Because it's a Prius.
Yeah, it is a Prius.
Yeah, and so it's got no traction, no power, no nothing. So I'm trying to rock it out, and as I'm trying to push it forward, I hit something and then smash the front of it. So it's it was a human error. So I admit that and say that was all my fault.
Okay.
Yeah. But now it's got two dents, and I don't know why we're talking about my car, but again, you like to bring that up. So I think we're going to take a very short break.
Good time
is a good time to break because, frankly, I don't want to talk about this anymore.
Okay.
But we're going to bring on our guest. He's up next. He's got a riveting story about what's it like to grow up, not to grow up. He probably grew up in a family that had a little bit of addiction because I know that for a fact, but also to live in a house with a spouse that's struggling with addiction and some of the problems that has come out of that. And there's a big happy ending to this story, so we're looking forward to that as well.
Fabulous.
Yeah. So we're going to take a short break and listen to Real Recovery with Bill Arnold and George Frazier on Faith Radio.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Just let me say before I close up the video with you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold with George Frazier. We're having a great discussion tonight about step 5. We've dissected that a little bit, George. We got to start going, don't we?
I think we buried it, Bill.
No, we didn't. We didn't bury it, but we got a nice start going. And we've got a guest that's going to help share and some of his story tonight. And he's also going to talk a little bit about step 5 in the process. He will talk about how that fits in. Our guest tonight has asked for anonymity, so I think we'll call him Walter, even though his real name is Steve. Is that all
about
right,
Steve?
So anyway, Walter, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I don't want to make that same mistake I made with that witness relocation program.
Yeah, well, thanks for joining the program, and welcome to Real Recovery.
Yeah, thanks.
You have had a little brush with addiction, I mean, starting in your family of origin, growing up, didn't you?
Well, I mean, more than just a brush, you might say it's actually a full-on hair salon.
Okay.
Siblings, you know, nobody in my family, in fact, you know, I come from a rather large family. We're not Mormon, nothing like that, not that large.
Mm-hmm.
But have really nary a drinker in the bunch, actually. But we seem to have accumulated quite a few of myself, siblings, that have married into the problem.
Mm-hmm. So you've certainly had a brush with it, but more recently,
yeah.
You've had a brush with it in your own household.
Yes. Yeah, when you say recent, of course, obviously, these stories always take on a life of their own in terms of how much of your life they actually eat up as you sit around waiting for things to just get better all by themselves. And they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And you suddenly find that years, just years of your life disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, when I first started going to even some Al-Anon meetings and learning about it from my perspective, the advice and guidance was always so frustrating. And yet, of course, in retrospect, I look back now and say, well, every last word of it they told me was true. You have very little power over it as the spouse of somebody with this. You kind of do what you can do. But, and actually, Bill, it was a book that you pointed me to, that Deborah J. book.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the big turning points for me and my family, is we just had to bring the bottom up, because it really does. It's inevitable. A bottom will get hit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that day is coming.
Explain to the listeners what you mean by that.
Yeah. Well, you know, somebody's going to hit bottom. You just hope that they will have a moment, a life-changing moment, that they say, I've got to stop doing this. You don't want it to be something horrific, of course. You know, you certainly pray that it isn't something like serious harm, death, an irreversible illness of sorts. You know, there's so many, many things that can go wrong. And in order to prevent that from happening, you have to change as best you can, as the loved one, where that bottom is. And that might mean that you have to say some pretty tough stuff to get that person to make a choice. It's hard. I don't think there's ever been anything harder in my life, you know, to have to, you know, give, as they say, an ultimatum. It's tough stuff.
Dave, what's that like to sit back and watch the person you love and care about just destroy themselves and take you down with them? What all goes along with that emotionally and physically, et cetera?
Well, I mean, you know, it means that you can't function wholly as a person at all. You know, if you have a job, well, you're going to be doing a subpar performance at your job because your life is going to be consumed with wondering if everything's okay at the homestead, if everybody's safe, healthy, if there's a disaster waiting for you when you get home, and maybe you should go home early today. But, you know, it has far more reaching implications, I feel, in terms of people it affects. You know, when you are dragged down with this, it affects your personal relationships with everybody else. And then suddenly you could be the person that everybody's going, that guy's the downer. Boy, oh boy, you know what? I'd drink if I was married to him too, because you're so all consumed with it. You know, your friend could kind of get tired of conversations that if there is a handful of friends that are in the know of what's going on, they're going, oh, I don't have to hear this story again. You know, I mean, it's horribly stressful. If there are children involved, it's, you know, let's face it, when you're on your own, if it's just you and a spouse, you know, you always have the option of saying, well, I'll just up and go. And then this person, if they're just going to self-destruct, I don't have to be there to watch it. If you love that person, you know, of course you don't want to just up and go. Second, if there are children involved, that choice is not as easily made. So you worry, you stress, you don't sleep. You know, if there are young children involved and somebody's using, chances are it will be very difficult for them to respond to a child's cries in the middle of the night, so you want to be sure to be that person to do it. Should, you know, you know how kids are. Somebody could fall out of a crib. You know, anything could happen. So you suddenly find yourself being pretty ragged, too.
Gosh, I would guess at a certain point, too, the thought's got to come to somebody's mind, if this person really loved me, they'd stop doing this, right?
Yeah, although I will say, you know, a group like Al-Anon has really helped me with that. You start to understand with the disease that, you know, they're not thinking in their right frame of mind. It's absolutely true that if they really loved you, they wouldn't do these things. But you're not talking to the same person you were talking to. You know, it's a different person, and you would see personality changes. I mean, I'm sure many of your listeners have experienced that. They say, this, you know, I'm married to three people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's person A, person B, and then, boy, when person C shows up, I can handle A and B relatively well. The sober person, the I've got one drink in me person. But when person number three shows up, which is the couple or more or whatever they've been doing all day, you just prepare yourself for battle because you're the enemy. And it's nothing personal. It just sounds personal when they take it out on you. The person that you're married to is having an affair.
Yep.
And, you know, most people think of an affair, obviously, as a physical human being that they're involved with. But I tell you, you know, those I would say would be easier to deal with. I think, I can't say for sure, but because this other one is nasty. This is, you know, a Glenn Close sort of a fatal attraction. The person they're having an affair with, the item they're having an affair with, it does not let go.
Absolutely. We would not have a personal relationship with anybody that treated us the way our drug of choice treated us. Just wouldn't
happen. Yeah, and, you know, I think if somebody were having an actual physical affair with somebody, they would be, at least you would think, in the driver's seat of being able to call it off at some point in time and say, well, I've done damage to my marriage. I've got to try and repair that. But this jerk, this other type of addiction, says, not so fast. Not so fast, buddy. You are not getting rid of me. You know, I do not go quietly.
It's menacing, isn't it?
It's menacing. And when you're the person who's the sober one, obviously you can see pretty clearly that, my gosh, this person's not thinking clearly. They're not in their right mind about this issue. And this thing can manipulate every thought they have. It's sinister.
And you actually become the adversary, don't you? You're no longer the partner. You're the adversary because you're the one trying to help the person stop.
And right, they look at you as the enemy. Yeah, you're getting in the way.
Well, the insanity here, guys, is contagious in that the addict or alcoholic is insane, and they can spread that around the family very quickly.
Yeah, I think that that's a great way to put it. It's, you know, the paranoia that they experience quickly becomes you have your own paranoia. The next thing you know, and we have modern technology these days, you know, with smartphones, you could track where somebody is. So here you are, you know, you used to be able to live in this beautiful, blissful ignorance of what was going on, and you could just think the best of any daily situation, saying, well, that person's not out at the liquor store, when you could maybe look at your phone and say, well, darn it, there they are at the liquor store again.
Mm.
And you become the paranoid one, and now you're watching them all day long because you're worried sick, you know, you're concerned about their well-being, and you know, you have veritable lie detectors at your disposal all the time, where if you're staring that person in the face and they're telling you about their day, and you know that 80% of what's coming out of the mouth is a complete fabrication.
Mm.
And by having that ability to do that, and suddenly you have an addiction to it because you're like, I need to know. I need to know the truth. But it's a horrible way to live.
So you're sucked down a little bit of the same rabbit hole in a way. Because
I call it a rat hole.
Yeah, rat hole.
Yeah. Yes.
Rabbits are kind of cute and cuddly.
It's
more of a rat hole.
You know, it is a rat hole.
Yeah. What do you understand about codependency, George? Maybe I should ask you that question first because you're the expert. Explain that to the listeners, and maybe I want to see if it applies. I mean, what is codependency in this?
Oh, you
whole
just
deal?
Asked the narcissist what he thought about codependency. I'm not sure I'm your guy. What I see more than anything in recovery, and I'm an addict who's in recovery, is that I think all addicts and alcoholics are codependent before they have an addiction. And what I mean by that is we put another person above our own needs and wants. In other words, Bill, gosh, I can't be happy unless you're happy.
Good. I like that.
No, I've worked through that one.
That was an easy one. I think on that go ahead.
But what we do is we lose ourselves in another person, and we confuse our identity that we have in Christ. We lose that in another person because my well-being depends on how you feel towards me.
Okay, Einstein, hold on to that thought. We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we're going to have more with our guest tonight. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill Arnold and George Fraser on Faith Radio.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery. You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold with George Fraser. We're having a very interesting conversation tonight with a guest who has asked for anonymity. Am I saying that right, George?
Yeah, very, very good job.
And we have him on the line. His name is Rajiv.
Yes.
Can we call him Raj?
Yeah, we'll call him Raj.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would appreciate
is that okay?
That.
You're not
That's
offended
fine.
By that?
That's fine.
That's fine. Yeah.
So, Raj, give us a little insight as to what happened. What you helped bring the bottom up in your family. You've got a spouse that was struggling with alcoholism, and you helped bring the bottom up and brought her to a place of discovery that said, oh, boy, the gig's up. I need some help. Would you explain how that went?
Well, it actually went better than I thought it would. But it takes a huge amount of support. So if you are the person in the relationship that is, you know, on the receiving end of the addict, get as much support as you can. You know, Al-Anon type places are, of course, fantastic if there's family you can reach out to. Because at some point in time, one of the things I've discovered in my little experience with this is, and maybe, George, you'll know more.
Doubt it.
At least I hope so. Otherwise,
doubt it.
Doubt it.
Doubt it.
But, you know, it's not just the addict, you know, everything becomes your fault. But the addict, one of their favors that they ask of you is to keep things secret. Don't let anybody know. This will just be between us. And it's just a ploy to keep other people out of it, because obviously they don't want anybody ganging up on them. They don't want the whole family involved. Well, I did a few years ago reach out to get the family involved, and I paid the price for it for quite some time. I mean, that was used as a, you know, as kind of a weapon against me. It's like, how dare you bring those people into it? What do you treat me like a child? But it ultimately ended up being the best thing I did, because when I needed strength, when it came time, and members of the family said, we've had it, we've got to do this, and I knew the time was coming, we set up a time to meet with her doctor that she had been seeking some treatment for anxiety and stress with, saying, we're not asking you to violate any of your confidentiality with her, but here's what's going on. And surprisingly, he said, I have been concerned as well. I've had blood test results, very disturbing stuff. So what do you guys want to do? And we said, we think it's time. You know, we just have to lay down the law, and it's ultimatum time, because her own personal health is greatly at risk. And we were very fortunate that we had a physician that said, I will conduct it, and we will do it in my office, where it's a safe zone for you. You don't want to be doing this in your home. And he was amazing in how he ran the whole thing. We all had to come prepared. You know, there were things that we had to have. You know, you see those TV shows and you go, oh, did you write a nice little letter that said, you know, that's all teary-eyed and things like that. And we did. There was some of that. We didn't really go and read them. You know, you could sit there and you could spend hours saying, well, here's another thing you did. Here's another thing. Here's another thing you did. Would only serve to make the person angry. Basically, what we had to do is say, here is our plea to you, and then these are the consequences if you don't. And they had to be real, and they had to be backed up. And that was the hardest part, because, you know, knowing Bill and knowing some of the work that you guys do, I've heard some scary statistics that there's a good percentage of people that say, well, take your ultimatums, and you know what you can do with them.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing you know, they've told the family to disband and see you all later, and I'm breaking up all communication with you guys because my addiction is much more important.
Mm-hmm.
That's the scariest thing going into it, is not just that you're doing this and you're going to be confronting this person and you're afraid of some, it's going to get personal, it's going to get ugly. You're kind of prepared for that, and you're saying, well, they're going to say things, and people are going to say, what's this thing about you and that monkey? You know, there was no monkey. There was no monkey, you know. I mean, you don't know what they're going to say. Because this animal, this beast that has them, is hanging on for dear life at this point in time, and it knows that the jig is up at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly do look at this. I didn't used to look at it as a disease. I didn't used to look at it as a demon. It's a demon, and it's got a personality, and it's got plans. So we went and prepared for that as best we could, but you do have to be prepared to make good on, you know, they're not threats. The promises, you know, if you don't, this is what is going to have to happen. And the scariest part for me was that, you know, perhaps my wife might say, fine, see ya. I think that's what a lot of people fear, and maybe that's why they're more, they're reluctant and they delay doing what needs to be done. Because they say, well, what if this person tells me to get lost? It's like, then you got to be prepared for that. You can't live like this, and neither can they.
George and I have met a lot of people that have taken that approach, and they've ended up back in treatment 5 years, 10 years later for the 15th time, and they don't have a lot of friends or family or job or employment or anything, and they don't necessarily have a lot of teeth in a row either.
Well, what we're trying to do here, guys, is keep somebody alive. Let's not forget that, and you have to be prepared to back up what you're saying. And it is hard. I've been at situations, Raj, where, you know, there'll be a dad and all of the kids will say, Dad, you know, here's what you did last Christmas and we love you and care about you. But, you know, unless, you know, you change your ways and go into treatment, we're not going to let you around the grandkids. And I've seen them say, okay, you're out of my life. You're out of my life. You're out of my life. And so are you. And wow, is that shocking and is that painful and hurtful?
Yep.
And it doesn't always work out rosy. There's a risk
no, but,
here.
I do think that the alternative is equally as ugly. I don't really foresee it. You know, one of the things that was really helpful when we were having the intervention, and I would ask my wife, I'd say, how do you think this is going to end? Do you think that you're going to wake up one day and suddenly say, you know, I actually don't think I'm going to drink anymore? It doesn't magically disappear. It will not magically disappear.
Amen.
And so if you know that as the codependent, because you have to know that, it is not going to magically disappear. When you get to this point, if you do, that you're doing this intervention, you have to realize the reason why you're going to make good on these promises is because it is not going to get better, and your life is going to get worse. It is going, I mean, I watched over a course of 2 years, it get worse and worse and worse. We were so fortunate. No one got hurt. There was some physical difficulties that my wife was having, but the doctors say that she should be fine. But, you know, you start to look at the risk you ran. You know, you were not very far away from starting the onset of cirrhosis. And once you get that baby going, well, good now, of course, you'll probably never quit drinking because your whole attitude is going to be, why should I bother?
Sure.
I'm dying anyway.
That's depressing, isn't it? When you start getting that news, you go, what's the point now?
Yeah, but the reason why you got to stick to your guns on this and be serious about that threat is you know it's a fact it's going to get worse. It will get worse. That person will not wake up someday and say, son of a gun, I'm done with drinking. Look at that. That was cool. I just had to wait it out.
Mm-hmm.
Just a storm, just a brief little storm. It's a tsunami, and it keeps on coming, and it just hits and hits and hits and hits. And, you know, even if the person gets a couple of days of sobriety under their belt, boy, that's just, you know, like, I've got to celebrate. I must celebrate this amazing accomplishment.
I've been there.
Yeah.
I've been there. You're absolutely right. This thing is so destructive and so powerful. Bill, he used the word demon. The longer I'm in recovery and the longer I'm working with addicts, there's really a demonic piece here that Satan doesn't want people to get sober. And drug addiction and alcoholism is a great way to destroy lives and kids and break the family apart. And people do lose hope. And once we lose hope, we're not going to get sober. We're not going to walk with God because why should we? And it is bigger than we are. And we need the help of Jesus and we need the help of Christian friends. I really like the fact they got the doctor involved here. If something like this is done, there's professional interventionists. And the reason they do this is it gets hot. It gets ugly. You are threatening the one thing the person is using to survive with. And they cannot imagine surviving without that. And you need to have somebody that they don't have a relationship with in there kind of directing the traffic, because the bullets can start flying on these deals pretty quick. Right, Rich?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, before we did it with the doctor, when we were just trying to do it with the family, yeah, the bullets flew. And it's a spray, and it is an automatic weapon. Boy, that baby, once it starts to go, and once that person pulls the trigger, it's a grip of death, boy, and the room's getting sprayed, and take no prisoners. You know, I apologize. I usually avoid cliches like the plague, but, you know, it seems to fit so perfectly here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's ugly, but I am here to tell you, if anybody is interested, it will be worth it. There's only two possible outcomes. The person is going to tell you to take a hike. That was inevitable then. I don't know if that person was going to come around without something. It meant that your threats, you're trying to bring the bottom up. If your threats, and again, I will stress the word promises, because you have to mean it. If your promises of the consequences of them not getting help now, I mean today, if they don't take them seriously, that means that you brought the bottom up to where you're comfortable and they're not there yet. That just means there's a tough road ahead. There's a new bottom coming.
Yep.
It's going to be lower. So, you know, you got to bring that bottom up. You choose or they choose. The disease chooses, actually. The disease will choose. And it never chooses a nice place. You know, jail, a hospital, court. It ends, you know, that's where the disease chooses to end it.
You forgot the morgue.
Morgue. Yeah.
Usually, yeah. That's a place,
to reassemble.
Too.
Yeah. So you do it now. So there's only two possible outcomes. The person can pay to take a hike. You need to go then, because that means that what they're saying in essence is, I haven't reached my bottom yet. And if you think it's ugly now, just wait till they reach whatever that bottom is. You haven't got a clue. You better get out. You don't want to be around when that bottom's hit, because it might, you know, they might land on you. The other possibility is they say, I don't want to go. I don't want to go, but they go.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm here to say the transformation in just the short time, you know, once my wife got a clear head, it's been unbelievable. And suddenly all of the pain of going through that experience is nothing. It's gone. It doesn't exist. It's erased. It's very biblical. You know, when you think about it, Job went through many, many troubles. God erased it. The memories were even gone of it. It's like, what trouble? What are you talking about? Things have always been good, right? I mean, it seems like there's salvation for you if you say, I'm stepping in, here's your intervention, this is what's got to happen. If you don't, it's hard to save you. It's just hard. You know, I mean, you just have a choice of multiple hard paths.
Yeah, no kidding.
I'll be the first. I'm sure there's a million people that will tell you this, and I'll be just add my voice to the pile. It doesn't magically go away. And the other person has an hour of sobriety, and honest to God, the optimist or the fool in you, it's one of the two, most likely the fool, says, hey, this is good. Great. Maybe this is a start of something good. Come on. I've been sober for half a day.
Right. You know, oftentimes when I hear about these stories and how people go down addiction paths, they want to initially maybe relax a little bit, so they have some alcohol, and they feel a little stressed out, so they maybe want something to help numb some of the bad feelings. But in the process of numbing the bad feelings, you start numbing the good feelings, and the person that you knew and love starts to disappear altogether. And when we come back, I want you to respond to that. We're going to take a very short break. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill Arnold and George Fraser on Faith Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery. You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold with George Fraser.
What's up, Bill? Fraser's down.
I'm talking to you.
You're talking to me?
I'm talking to you.
Okay.
You want a piece of me?
I'd love it. I'd love it.
Seriously, you'd be picking up your teeth.
I would like you guys. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
You probably spared me from the lawyers being involved. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
It's not real maturity here. It's real recovery.
Important.
Yeah.
Not only have I enjoyed this interview, but I've actually completed 3 Sudokus during the interview. So that's
good for you. Congratulations.
Yeah.
I went from beginner level to expert throughout
nice.
The course of the show, so I feel the healing properties.
Good. You can multitask during this episode, this award-winning episode of Real Recovery. But we are speaking to Rajiv. We call him Raj. Who's asked for anonymity tonight, and he's been telling us a story about being in a household with a spouse dealing with alcoholism. And we, you know, in 1 Peter 5:7, it says, casting all your care upon him because he cares about you. How did you feel about how God was treating you and your family during this time of this insanity?
Yeah, this will surprise you. I was mad at him.
No.
When was the last time you heard that?
I didn't see that one coming.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, you want something to strike down from the heavens and go, boom, hey, this person suddenly gets it today.
Mm-hmm.
God does not work that way, and we know he doesn't work that way. In retrospect, after going through the intervention process and then, getting somebody into recovery and seeing what has happened. Now I take a step back and I've got the little magnifying glass, and boy, oh boy, do I see God's fingerprints all over the place, all over the place. Couldn't see him before.
Did you have a hard time crying out to God, pleading for him, or was that easy for you during this time?
You kind of got tired of it, and you say to yourself, gosh, you know what it is, I need God. You know what's going on here, and how is this going to go down? I think obviously at some point I had to realize that God said, it's all set. You have things to do. You're involved in this too. You have things to do. I'm not going to just snap my fingers and things are magically done. This is all of you are involved. All of you are there. All of you will benefit from this. All of you get to work, get off your butts, get going. You have stuff to do. And I realized I had a part to play, and I had a very tough part to play. It's like, you want the person who's with the addiction. I want them to do all the hard work. They're the one that's, drinking or doing whatever it is they're doing. I don't have to do anything. I'm perfect. Or I'm not perfect, but I'm at least more perfect. Or I haven't done anything wrong. I mean, these are all thoughts that flow in and out of your head. And you realize, and then you get mad that you realize I have to do something. Well, that's not fair either. I didn't ask for this. Why am I having to do something? Why do I have to deliver the goods here that's going to be extremely difficult on me? I've got nothing to do with this. I'm not the one with the problem. And when the dust settles, you say, I get it. I get the whole thing. I am part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I am a little bit a part of this problem too, this exact problem. I have enabled it. I have been a codependent, and now I have to stop. So, at the end, like I say, I look around and go, God's fingerprints are everywhere.
That's great to hear that you've got that insight. I think that only comes from God, guys. And part of what we see here, and we see this all the time, Raj, in recovery, is the people that are codependent have to take step one, just like we do. And step one for us is we admitted we were powerless, that our lives had become unmanageable. And when people that are involved in relationships with us, they have to do the same thing, because we're great at getting you to call the boss and say that I'm sick again today, or, maybe cover up that I've driven with the kids when I've been drinking, and little things like that that, do affect everybody in the family, and we talk about it being a family illness, not just an individual illness.
Yeah, it is. It affects everybody.
And at a certain point, you've got to make a decision that you're not going to do it anymore, too. And it sounds like that's exactly what you did.
It is. Well, in part, there's a step one to the codependent. I am powerless over their powerlessness.
Right?
I mean, it's like, if they're powerless, then what power do I have over somebody who's powerless over something? We need help.
Yeah, everybody needs help, don't they?
Yeah, there's only one place to go.
Yep, I agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, Raj, there's a question I have for you, because right now you have been through the thick of this right now, and you're on a slightly different place where you are looking, you're looking in a much different direction coming forward. But there are lots of families out there tonight. There are lots of people who are in the situation you were previously in that are completely and entirely out of their minds. And they would love a word of encouragement. They would love advice. They would love something just to give them a little bit of hope. Can you start giving some of that?
Yeah. I will tell you this. My wife has been in a place now. Getting recovery. She's been there for a couple of weeks, and
so this is pretty raw. This is pretty fresh.
It's unbelievable, really. The change to hear her again, to speak to somebody, and I get to speak to her on the phone, and speak to somebody who I realize I haven't talked to this person in a couple of years.
Wow.
It's unbelievable, and you. The pain of everything that you are currently experiencing and the pain of having to step in and do an intervention, I promise you this, it disappears I can't get over it. There's a literal spring in my step. I mean, when I put her on that plane, I left the airport. Upset. I was crying, but, you know, the relief that came with it, I can't explain it to you. And then to watch her each day get clearer and clearer and clearer, there is a ton of sunshine at the end of this. Not only is there help out there, you will kick yourself. Why didn't I do this sooner? Now, that person has a timeline, and, you can intervene, and you may not be able to force it to happen sooner than they're really ready for, but you've got to bring that bottom up. And when you do, and when you start to talk to that person that you fell in love with and that you know, whatever the family member is, maybe it's a child or a parent or something like that, when you hear that voice again, and every bad thing you went through, it starts to melt away. I mean, wrongs will have been done to you. You will have been lied to repeatedly for years. And that person will, with conviction, stare you in the eyes and without a blink tell you a falsehood, and you know it's a falsehood, and you will be disturbed at their ability to do it with such ease and regularity. It goes away because that person is back. The real person is back, not that the person that stepped in, not the diseased person. And I got to tell you, it does your heart an amazing amount of good when you hear that person speaking, saying, oh, my gosh, was I sick. Oh, my gosh, do I have a disease? I'm sick. And the gratefulness that my wife has shown toward me over the last 2 weeks, you know, and it wasn't that way when I put her on the plane, trust me.
Mm-hmm.
But to hear her say, thank you, you saved my life. You saved our family. It will make all the bad go away. And you will realize that it was something that you had to do. And I'm telling you, you will see God's fingerprints. All you'll see handprints, footprints. You'll see God all over the place. He's got something he wants you to do. If you're the codependent suffering, God has a job for you in all of this. You have a job. God is giving you a task. And he will reward you handsomely for carrying out your duty. You just got to do it. I hope I never have to go through anything like this again. I pity anybody that's suffering with it. It'll be worth it. You know, I heard my wife's voice after the getting clear for a few days, and I realized that I still loved her as much as I did the day I married her. And it was just nice to be able to talk to her again. And I can't wait to get her back.
Wow. That's very, very passionate and powerful. And I'm guessing that she might even be listening to this program.
Yeah.
And if she is by chance listening, go ahead and say hi to her.
Hi, honey. Juanita. Raj.
Yeah.
You could speak in your native tongue, Raj, if you want to, too. We wouldn't mind. I think it's a great story of, you know, perseverance, Bill, and honesty, and above all, love. And you know, we're supposed to love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love our neighbor as ourselves. And it's a hard thing to be in a relation with somebody who's in active chemical use and to say you love them and just watch them deteriorate. And a lot of times we don't know what to do. And as he said, he was mad at God. He didn't deserve this. And you can make an argument for all of that, but what is our piece in this? Are we enabling? Are we continuing this so, you know, we're not embarrassed or so this doesn't get hurt? We're trying to control a situation that only God can change. And what we need to do is try to bring it to a situation where the person is empowered. The person is empowered to make the right choice to change their lives. And this sounds like a great victory. And a lot of times, guys, it doesn't happen that way. And a lot of times you do the right thing that God wants you to do, and you sit back and you don't get a great outcome. And what we learn from that is we're only able to take care of our side of the street. And that's hard, and we're being obedient, and the outcome's up to God. And the other person has to make the decision to change things just as we did to get an intervention or something going.
Yeah, But you can't live in a world of wishful thinking that it will suddenly go away and suddenly get better. If that person chooses to tell you to take a hike, you know, to use a colorful euphemism,
yep,
know that that is a sign to you that that person, they're signaling to you that they haven't hit bottom, that you were unable to bring their bottom up, and that some bad stuff might be coming. And then you have a choice. And that's why you have to follow through on what you said, because you don't want to be around when that bad thing happens. And I feel for people that what a horrible, you know, you're looking at those decisions and you say, wow.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah. Badly.
Raj, it's been a very, very wonderful hour. Thank you for sharing your story. I know it's going to touch a lot of lives and certainly left a big impact with George and me. Did I say that right, George?
You did. Actually, yeah. Your grammar was correct, and I look forward to having Raj back on a show in the future to get an update.
And maybe we can have his wife, Juanita, on as well.
Juanita.
You've been listening to Real Recovery. Thanks very much for listening tonight, another award-winning episode. God bless, and have a good week. Good night, everybody.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.